Yesterday, UN Ambassador Susan Rice met with Senators McCain, Graham, and Ayotte behind closed doors to explain remarks she had made on five Sunday morning TV news shows on September 16th. She had been asked about the attack on the U.S. mission in Benghazi, Libya, on September 11th that led to the deaths of four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador. Here's what she told CBS's Bob Schieffer.
Based on the best information we have to date, what our assessment is as of the present is, in fact, what it began spontaneously in Benghazi as a reaction to what had transpired some hours earlier in Cairo, where, of course, as you know, there was a violent protest outside of our embassy sparked by this hateful video. But soon after that spontaneous protest began outside of our consulate in Benghazi, we believe that it looks like extremist elements, individuals joined in that effort with heavy weapons of the sort that are unfortunately readily now available in Libya post-revolution, and that it spun from there into something much, much more violent.
Republicans pounced on those words, accusing Ambassador Rice of intentionally misleading the press and the public to protect the Obama administration weeks before the election. Senator McCain said after yesterday's meeting that he was still troubled by many of Rice's answers. We asked Eric Schmidt to join us on Radio Times. He's a senior writer who covers terrorism and national security issues for the New York Times, also co-author of a book called Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. And Eric Schmidt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Listening to what Susan Rice said to Bob Schieffer, and also actually looking at what she told all those hosts that Sunday morning, was she right? Was she wrong based on some of the reporting that you have done?
Well, clearly, and she's acknowledged this, as have other officials in the administration, they now say this was not a spontaneous protest or demonstration, that this was an organized attack by members of terrorist groups, including the local al-Qaeda affiliate. But this was, as she pointed out at the time, this was the best information that they had at the moment. And most importantly, she was operating off unclassified talking points that were prepared for her by the CIA. These talking points differed in some significant aspects from the classified version that had been given to lawmakers just a few days before, that went into more detail about the groups that the CIA suspected might be involved, and it was more explicit that they believed this was a terrorist attack. So in just a few days, between lawmakers got this more detailed briefing on what they believe, the agency believed, was a terrorist attack, and what seemed to be a more sanitized version just a few days later prepared for dissemination on the talk shows and by members of Congress. That's why you had a lot of Republicans in particular saying, hey, what's going on here? Why does there seem to be such a disparity between these two?
And does anyone know who sanitized these talking points?
Well, as it came out last night, it now appears that it was done by some relatively mid to low-level CIA analysts who were concerned that in just these immediate days after the attack, that by identifying these groups, that might, in effect, tip them off that the U.S. was on to them and pursuing them for this. There were also some concerns voiced by the Justice Department, the FBI, that it could hamper their criminal investigation that they had just launched into these groups. These concerns were voiced just a couple of weeks ago to members of Congress as the CIA and Susan Rice and others in the administration tried to explain why these talking points were prepared the way they were. But this explanation, you know, has met with some skepticism among Republicans, as you noted in your introduction.
Well, and I noticed that in all these interviews, she used the word extremists rather than extremists with ties to al-Qaeda. Is extremist a stand-in word for terrorist?
Well, it is in the most generic sense, of course. I mean, you could say militants, extremists. But I think the argument coming from many Republicans and even some terrorism experts would say that that's kind of over-sanitizing what you could do. You could say these were suspected terrorist groups. I mean, it didn't take a rocket scientist to think that the local al-Qaeda affiliate in North Africa might have some involvement in this, as well as the Ansar al-Sharia group, which is the local Libyan extremist group that now U.S. officials believe was largely responsible for the attack. So one could argue, I suppose, that the intelligence analysts were being overly cautious in substituting the word extremist for the more specific description of the actual groups.
Well, she did apparently or reportedly say that she made a mistake when she made those statements on September 15th. But I'm curious, why do you think McCain and Ayotte and Graham have been so critical and seem not to accept her apology yesterday?
Well, I think Senator Graham, suggested, as did Senator Ayotte, that they don't necessarily believe that there wasn't some other ulterior political motive here. And that that motive perhaps could have been the whole idea that if you if this was indeed a successful terrorist attack by an al-Qaeda franchise against the U.S. mission in Benghazi, that would undercut the narrative that the Obama administration has held as one of its crowning foreign policy achievements, that is the death of Osama bin Laden and the decimation of al-Qaeda's core leadership. The administration, the White House, has strenuously denied that there was any involvement for political reasons here, but Senator Graham and Senator Ayotte in particular yesterday voiced skepticism that there still wasn't some other reason that the explanation was as it was made by Susan Rice that day.
Well, General Petraeus had actually testified earlier this month telling both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees that the assault was a terrorist attack. And I have to say that the more I read about this and got deeper into the research, the more, frankly, confused I was getting in terms of who said what when. And it seems like the timeline is so important to trying to understand what went on and who was describing particular events.
You really need a scorecard, Marty,
to
keep track of all this, and a timeline is very helpful for this because it is confusing. I think, again, what happened was in just a couple of days after the attack, General Petraeus went up to the Hill and in a closed session briefed lawmakers on what he and the intelligence community knew then, and that is this much more detailed, classified description that they did believe this was a terrorist attack, an opportunistic attack carried out by two or three different specific groups. They were pursuing leads at that time, and again, so it was a fairly specific briefing. Right. When it came time just a few days later for Susan Rice to go on the television talk shows, however, she couldn't take that classified description and go on air with it. That was too much detail, both Intelligence Committee and Justice Department officials said. So that's where they came up with these much more generic talking points that have left everyone very frustrated. And kind of compounding things, apparently yesterday in Susan Rice's meeting with the senators, the acting CIA director, Michael Morell, joined her and apparently at one point misspoke and said it was actually the FBI that had changed the wording from the specific references to terrorist groups to the word extremist, as you used. He misspoke, and in fact, that's not what was happened, and the CIA had to rush up later and make calls up to the Hill and say, no, it wasn't the FBI that did that, it was the CIA, we were the ones who changed it. And all that did was really, I think reinforce some of the skeptics about whether the administration can get its story straight on this whole episode.
On that terrible, fateful day when those four Americans died, President Obama did go into the Rose Garden to address the nation and to talk about what had happened. Did he make a reference to the possibility of a terrorist attack?
He did indeed. He talked about acts of terror immediately after. It came in the context of certainly the attack on Benghazi, although it wasn't a specific reference to that attack. I mean, I think even the White House the next day or two afterward didn't really draw attention to it, or even after this controversy kind of flared up after Susan Rice made her remarks, again, raising some question about what the president was actually saying. Was he actually referring specifically to the Benghazi attack, or was he talking more generically about attacks in general? But he did actually mention those words, yes.
Is it possible to say that what some of this confusion was the so-called fog of war?
Oh, sure. And I think that's in any event like this, and certainly the sources that I talked to immediately afterward were quick to say was this is a very fluid situation. This is a snapshot in terms of what we know now. Of course, there was information that came out that night was very sketchy. Of course, there was a lot going on in the Middle East and North Africa. There were protests and demonstrations at more than two dozen other American embassies or consulates around the Middle East and all. So it was a very confusing, hectic night, and it took some time for the intelligence community to try and sort this out. That said, my colleagues, for instance, David Kirkpatrick and one of our local Libyan correspondents, interviewed some of the fighters that evening in and they were the ones who did say that they indeed had been motivated by at least the word of the video that had been played and the protests that it had sparked in places like Cairo at the embassy there. So even the Republican objections today that the video played no role in this, I don't think quite holds water if you go back and actually interview, as we did, some of the individuals on the ground who attacked the mission that night in Benghazi.
As I said, the deeper I got into this, the more questions I had, one of them being, why was Ambassador Susan Rice sent to be interviewed on these Sunday morning talk shows that tend to make so much news? Why not General Petraeus? Why not Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State?
Yeah. Well, at that time, it wasn't yet clear how large a role the CIA was playing. Of course, we now know that the second site that was attacked that evening, the so-called annex, was actually a secret CIA base, and that most of the Americans who were in Benghazi that night, official government, that is, were CIA officers of one side or another. That wasn't known, however, in the first immediate few days. So Secretary Clinton would have been a natural choice. However, she'd been doing a lot of travel. Her staff had said she was tired. She doesn't really like to do the talk shows anyway, so the White House asked Susan Rice to go on instead. Obviously, as UN ambassador, she had been briefed on the general contours of this issue, but she hadn't been as deeply involved, of course, as either Secretary Clinton or General Petraeus had.
And when some high-level official is given talking points, as Susan Rice was given, are they required to stick to those talking points? How does that work?
Well, again, somebody like Susan Rice, as any other senior cabinet officer in this position, would have been had access to the more detailed classified description with all the caveats that it might have. But again, she can't go out in public and say those things. So mm-hmm. what she does typically, in this case, it was actually the House Intelligence Committee requested some unclassified talking points that their members could use. And so these were the same talking points that Susan Rice could use in speaking to national television audience. But as we've discussed, there were concerns within both the CIA, the FBI, others, that if Susan Rice or anyone else went into as specific a detail as they could go into in classified form, that could jeopardize a number of things, both jeopardize the investigation into this as well as tip off the insurgents that the Americans were on to them. The question now, however, is, you know, did they perhaps over-sanitize these? Could they have been more descriptive without jeopardizing operations or any internal investigation?
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. Eric Schmidt is a senior writer, covers terrorism and national security for the New York Times, co-author of a book called Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. And we're talking about UN Ambassador Susan Rice, some of her Republican critics, some interviews that she did on September 16th, just a few days after the attack on the mission and annex in Benghazi, Libya, that killed the U.S. Ambassador and three other Americans. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
AT&T Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, Dave and Aaron Go to Work. Created and performed by Barrymore Award-winning Philadelphia artists Dave Jotico and Aaron Cromie. Dave and Aaron Go to Work harkens back to the days of Laurel and Hardy, Charlie Chaplin, and Buster Keaton in a wordless comedy for all ages. Tickets for Dave and Aaron Go to Work are available now at 215-592-9560 or at 1812productions.org.
This Week in This American Life. Growing up in Minnesota, John says that nobody ever talked about the war that happened near his hometown, Mankato, or the mass execution there.
The place where that hanging happened, I would have hung out at the mall not far from there, a few blocks down the street. I would have ridden past that spot on my way to, you know, Pizza Hut with my buddies.
For Thanksgiving, a story of Indians and settlers this week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
When you think about Santa, the Easter Bunny, and the Tooth Fairy, you probably think about lovable, cuddly guys or gals. But in the new film, Rise of the Guardians, they bring out their tough side.
What we really wanted to do was kind of take a step to the side and present them in a totally new way.
Director Peter Ramsey is with us next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Eric Schmidt from The New York Times. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. So, Eric, who are these terrorist organizations in Libya?
Well, there's a local Libyan extremist group called Ansar al-Sharia. This is a group that is one of the many militias that have formed in opposition to the deposed dictator there, Muammar Gaddafi. And now is one of the strongest groups operating in eastern Libya and specifically in Benghazi. Interestingly enough, at least prior to this attack, it wasn't necessarily believed that this was an anti-Western group. They did work in some regard with the incipient Libyan government forming in Tripoli, but these were its members at least were made up. The bulk of the fighters who apparently attacked at least the mission. Mm. I remember there were two attacks. There was an initial attack on the diplomatic mission, and several hours later there was a second attack on the CIA annex later.
And is there any way to know, even looking out, let's say there's a protest or even attack, who's a terrorist and who's a terrorist sympathizer and who's just there as a protester?
Well, that was certainly one of the very confusing things in the initial hours and days afterward, is how do you sort all these out? Because in addition to that group, the intelligence community believes there were individual members, or at least individuals who sympathized or were members of the Al-Qaeda organization in North Africa, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. There may have been one or two fighters from the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Iraq that had filtered over into eastern Libya. So it's kind of this witch's brew of different militant groups, not all united under one banner, but who all pulled together or were drawn to the fighting that took place initially over nearly 2 hours at the diplomatic mission. But again, trying to sort out who was responsible, who organized this, there's no indication as yet this was premeditated in the sense of days or weeks or months, something like the 9/11 plot. This was something that probably came together in very short order, maybe just in a few hours.
But it was on September 11th.
It was indeed on that anniversary. So there was it was a very highly charged atmosphere. There had also been a eulogy, an online eulogy that day that the Al-Qaeda leader had made for a fallen Libyan terrorist. So there was a lot of things in play, and then you add to that the news of this video, which many of the fighters probably never saw, but they heard about it and the blasphemy that they would have attributed to that degradation of the Prophet Muhammad. And you have a very combustible situation.
Let me ask you one more question, then I do want
sure.
to get some callers in. But why was the mission so vulnerable to attack?
Well, this is one of the major questions that a State Department review being led by the veteran former diplomat Thomas Pickering is looking at. There had been a number of exchanges of emails between not just the embassy in Tripoli, but the mission in Benghazi about maintaining the level of security, which is at a relatively low level, and improving the physical security, the walls, security cameras, those kind of things. And I think what happened was you had a situation where when the embassy in Tripoli was reopened in the summer of 2011, I think most people at the State Department and even people who were assigned to the embassy thought that the security would improve over time. The Libyans were very pro-American. They appreciated the U.S. and NATO effort to oust Gaddafi. And so I think the thinking was that the security would improve and you wouldn't need a heavy military or certainly a military or even a large security footprint. But what really happened was the security worsened over time to the point where this past spring there were sporadic attacks against the Western targets, including the British embassy ambassador who was traveling in Benghazi. There was an IED attack against the consulate itself. And the State Department seemed to have been pretty much on autopilot, despite some concerns voiced by Ambassador Chris Stevens, who was killed in the attack, that security might need to be improved or at least maintained going in over the next several months.
Let me get to Barb from Mount Airy to join our conversation. And Barb, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
You know, right from the beginning, the head of Libya, whoever was that, a president or whatever it is, said, "I think this is terrorism." So right off the bat, I felt like I knew that they weren't telling something, and I thought, well, maybe it's politically better not to, because then they make a big deal out of a September 11th attack. And I'm trying to figure out why either we're surprised that somebody would not be forthcoming with all the details, or why we think we have the right to know every detail when we're really not the experts in everything. Why it's in the best public interest of the security of the United States for us to know everything at every moment. I don't really get why this is such a big deal, that if she was, elusive, or why her head is on the chopping block.
I hear you, Barbara. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Eric Schmidt, do you have an answer for Barbara?
Well, I think you have to remember this all fell into the context of a very heated presidential campaign. This obviously fell on September 11th, just a little less than two months before the presidential election. And Republicans seized on this as what they believed was an example of the administration fudging the facts to support the narrative of one of their crowning foreign policy achievements, that is the death of bin Laden and the decimation of the core al-Qaeda leadership, to acknowledge, again, in this skeptical view, that an al-Qaeda franchise was able to carry out this kind of successful deadly attack would undermine that narrative. That was kind of the skeptical view of it, and Susan Rice's portrayal of what happened that night kind of fed into that. The administration has vigorously denied that from the beginning, rejected that, and basically saying they were putting out to the public as much information as they could, and that they felt prudent, understanding that the facts on the ground might change as they got more information. The central question, as we've been discussing, however, was, did these talking points maybe go too far in over-sanitizing what was at least suspected, if not fully known, just a few days after the attack?
Barb, thanks for the call. Let me get Bob from King of Prussia to join us on Radio Times. And Bob, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Good.
My question is pretty simple. It's if Barack Obama went into the Rose Garden and said and believed that it was a terrorist attack, then why then did he go in front of the UN and say numerous times that it had something to do with that YouTube video? That's my question, because I'm a little confused on that.
Bob, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Eric Schmidt, do you have an answer for Bob?
Well, again, this was one of the views that's supported by, pointed out by the skeptics. Why didn't the president just come out and very strenuously say this was a terrorist attack? We might not have all the information yet, but this is what we believe, and that's still a bit unclear. The White House, of course, does point to the fact that he did say there were acts of terror committed on that day, but the information that the White House and the rest of the administration was going on in those first several days was that the video did play some role. And in fact, today, if you ask the Intelligence Committee, they say that in fact it did play a role, in the sense that the fighters on the ground in Libya were inspired by what they had heard were these violent protests against the U.S. Embassy in Cairo, Egypt, which also were prompted and triggered by the response to this anti-Islam video. Mm-hmm. So the video does play a role in this. It's not to say that the fighters on the ground necessarily saw this video, but they heard about it. It was already a very combustible atmosphere that day. So I think the president was focusing on that. That was in part what was the information at the time, but he, of course, is now being criticized for not maybe be more specific, that this could have been be more specific in saying that it could possibly be a terrorist attack.
But are there good intelligence reasons to sanitize information about a terrorist attack?
Well, indeed, that's their whole point, was that even if you had suspected without full information, you wouldn't want to let the bad guys know that you're on to them. And that's indeed why they did sanitize what they had been briefing in classified session to members of Congress. And you ended up with what Susan Rice was talking about, and that is a very general reference to extremists rather than specific terrorist groups.
Final question for you, Erica. President Obama said after the attacks that the U.S. would kill or capture those responsible. Do you know what the progress is on that?
Well, unfortunately, according to my sources, the progress has been quite slow. The FBI has been carrying out the investigation, but it's mostly, except for one a relatively short 12-hour visit to Benghazi under several days, not weeks, after the attack, they've been pretty much relegated to having to operate out of the embassy in Tripoli and collect information from there. Mm-hmm. So there's been no real arrests made. There have been a couple of arrests made outside of Libya by other governments, Tunisia, for instance. But it's still very unclear as to how quickly the U.S. government will be able to make good on the president's promise.
And one more question.
Sure.
How many investigations are there into what happened at Benghazi?
Well, there are several, depending on how you parse it. There's the main State Department review that I referred to, conducted by former Ambassador Pickering. That will look at primarily the State Department's role and whatever lapses in security or intelligence they have. You also have a review being carried out by the Senate Intelligence Committee, led by Senator Dianne Feinstein. And she has said that after a couple more closed sessions of testimony, they will issue some findings and hold a public hearing, perhaps by the end of the year, to lay out what they believe happened, what went wrong, and what recommendations they might have.
Eric Schmidt, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're welcome.
And he's senior writer who covers terrorism and national security for the New York Times, co-author of a book called Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. Joining us now is Colm Lynch. He's United Nations reporter for The Washington Post, also reports from the UN on his foreignpolicy.com blog called Turtle Bay. And Colm Lynch, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much has been said about Ambassador Susan Rice. You have covered her at the United Nations. What's she like?
She's a complicated character. I mean, she's, you know, you meet her, she's very agreeable. She's very friendly, smart, charming, down to earth. She's also fearsome, and I think has a reputation as someone who you know, has sharp elbows, who's a bit of a bully, not unlike some of her colleagues, but very, very tough, curses a lot, but also, you know, quite charming, very knowledgeable about her brief, I tend to think.
Do you think she was an unusual choice to go on all those talk shows on September 16th after the Benghazi attacks?
I mean, the U.S. government, the White House sort of explanation is that Hillary Clinton had been sort of up from, you know, early in the morning to late at night working this and was exhausted, and so they thought to bring her in and hadn't initially planned on it. But, I mean, she is a cabinet member, if not Hillary Clinton. She certainly makes sense either to have someone like the National Security Advisor or Susan Rice. It appeared to be at a time when there was a lot of speculation as to whether she was going to be nominated as Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. So for all of us who pay, you know, attention to this sort of thing, it seemed like it was a bit of a signal that that she was being in some way anointed, prepared for the possible, you know, sort of coming nomination.
But do you see this as just a partisan political fight, or is there something about the credibility of Ambassador Rice at stake?
Well, I don't have a simple answer to that, but my feeling is that there certainly were problems, you know, obviously problems with the presentation. There were certainly serious problems and sort of shortcomings in, you know, as Eric talked about, in terms of the role that the U.S. government, the State Department in particular, played in not responding more actively to requests for security. I think that, you know, she was put forward also. I mean, this is someone who, you know, a lot of our top politicians are political appointees. So, you know, she's not someone who is a sort of traditional civil servant from the State Department, but someone who's kind of moved up in the ranks through kind of, you know, political channels. And so, the real question that the Republicans have is, you know, did they spin this to a certain degree to present a certain narrative which aligned with the president's sort of campaign sort of case that he had decimated Al-Qaeda. There was an important speech that he delivered before the UN General Assembly a couple of days later after the presentation that Rice made, in which, you know, he said that, you know, Al-Qaeda has been weakened and Bin Laden is no more. So did they spin it a little bit to emphasize what was a campaign narrative? I think it's quite possible. I don't know. There are certain sort of, you know, issues that I think are legitimate to look at in terms of the account that they provided, and also, you know, and I think more importantly, to look at the questions of security lapses, which I don't think she played a major role in. You know, however, you know, I cover her all the time, and you know, she has a long career in both as Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. You know, she had, you know, was very young sort of expert in the National Security Council during, you know, President Clinton's term. She's been engaged in a lot of big issues at the UN. And to me, it seems that, you know, if you want to look at a record, look at a record. And I don't know that this presentation is a great sort of representation of that. Sure, you know, have a look and examine the question of whether you think that she kind of spun, the information that she had. I mean, it sounds like, you know, she could say, can make a fairly good case that she was relying on CIA talking points that were consistent with what she said in that briefing. You know, it was very conditional language. You know, while she has backed off and said that that part of her presentation was incorrect, she did mention Al-Qaeda. She did leave open the possibility that that Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations were involved in the operation. So it was a fairly careful presentation, although key elements of it turned out to be wrong, and key elements of the original CIA talking points turned out to be wrong. So, I gather that some of this will be untangled by Pickering and the investigation that Eric talked about, former ambassador to the UN. And you know, we'll see what comes out of that. But what you would hope to see is that, you know, that the Senate, you know, is in part of its responsibility for vetting and examining candidates for important positions, that they would look more broadly at the broader role.
Let me ask you, she has been described, and you described her as someone both charming but also with sharp elbows. But I noted, especially from Senator McCain, that his criticism of her was very personal, said that she was not very bright. This is a woman who's a Fulbright scholar, not qualified if she is nominated to be the Secretary of State. Why do you think this personal language coming from Senator McCain?
I mean, that line about not very bright is extraordinary. It bears no relationship to it. Whatever you think about her, and a lot of people don't like her, And a lot of people don't like her for perfectly reasonable reasons, but how you make the case that she's not a bright person is it's absurd. I mean, she is, I've covered this place for a long time. I covered Madeleine Albright, I've covered Holbrooke, I've covered, you know, lots of U.S. ambassadors, and I got to tell you that there aren't many of them who have as strong a handle on the broad range of issues that she deals with. You might have questions about her judgment, about, you know, policy positions that she takes, but I mean, in terms of bare brains, she's got them. And it strikes me that this is, you know, that, you know, there apparently is some baggage. She went at him quite aggressively during the 2008 presidential campaign. I don't know if it relates to that. I don't know if he feels that the information that the questions that he's asking about the Benghazi case have been inconsistent, and he's pissed off about that. But I just don't know how you make the case that she's stupid.
Well, let's take a very short break, Colm, and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Colm Lynch. He's a UN reporter for the Washington Post, also reports from the UN on his farmpolicy.com blog called Turtle Bay. We're talking about UN Ambassador Susan Rice and Benghazi and some of the criticisms she has been getting from senators, including Senator John McCain, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Friends School Haverford, a co-ed Quaker school for preschool through 8th grade located in Haverford, Pennsylvania, minutes from the Blue Route and 76. Offering rigorous academics and a commitment to challenging each student in every subject, including a program that can take capable students through calculus. A microfarm and middle school travel and study adventure are a few of the hallmarks of their program. An open house is Sunday, December 2nd from 2 to 4 p.m. with activities for current 3rd through 7th graders and tours for parents. FriendsHaverford.org.
What's happening in Israel, Gaza, Egypt, Syria, Iran, Iraq, it's all interconnected with a lot of shifting and paradoxical alliances that are difficult to explain, which is why on the next Fresh Air, we talk with Robert Malley, the International Crisis Group's Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Hi, I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Author David K. Johnston lists 12 ways to protect against the next Hurricane Sandy. First on the list, increase spending on infrastructure. Also, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends doctors give girls under 17 just-in-case prescriptions for the morning after pill. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the fact that four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador to Libya, were killed in Benghazi on September 11th this year, something that we know. U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice appeared on five TV talk shows a few days later, suggesting the assault was a spontaneous response to an anti-Islamic film rather than a premeditated terror attack. Those words have led to a showdown between Susan Rice, the Obama administration, and a number of Republicans, including Senator John McCain. And we're talking with Colm Lynch, UN reporter for The Washington Post, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Colm, you quoted from a number of people in an article that you wrote about Susan Rice, even some liberals, journalists saying that she was ambitious and aggressive, that she cursed, she I think has given people the finger. Reminds me a little bit of Rahm Emanuel. And it's interesting to think that for Rahm Emanuel, that's charming, but for her, somehow that's disqualifying. And as a woman, I have to say, I find that kind of offensive.
Yeah. There has been very, I mean, it surprised me that you know, there was initially there was extremely, you know, sort of a tough critique coming out of the Republican side. And then all of a sudden, this whole sort of, you know, numerous articles started coming out from people who thought that the case on Benghazi was unsubstantiated and that wasn't grounds for, you know, blocking her, but that, I mean, in particular, Dana Milbank was quite critical of her in a piece that he, in a column he did in the Washington Post. So the thing is clearly she generates enormous emotion, and you know, I mean, my feelings about her are that, or my views on her as you know the ambassador is that she does have sharp elbows, and I can't see. I mean, I think it's very colorful, and it's interesting, and I like getting the quotes that she's telling people behind closed doors. But to me, does it say anything about what you can achieve diplomatically? Does it say that it produces results or it doesn't produce results? And if you kind of follow her, I mean, she will use very tough language when she's talking to the Russian ambassador Vitaly Churkin, who is also has a reputation for bullying, and so they go at it. And if you, think about her relationship with China's U.N. ambassador, who's a much more formal, old-fashioned, discreet diplomat, you don't see those kinds of outbursts, and you don't see that kind of relationship because it wouldn't work, it wouldn't get you anywhere. You know, it's hard to say, does the dynamics of a relationship with Churkin, has it made an impact on the nature of the relationship between the United States and Russia? Maybe on the margins it may have caused like some complications, but I think at the end of the day it doesn't mean that much. I mean, basically the relationship has been strained, particularly since the return of President Putin to power, and that there's much more fundamental sort of differences between the two countries that drive it.
We don't want diplomats always to play nice if you're dealing with a bully in this case.
Yeah, but there's two kinds of issues. There's the one that you talked about, which is sort of the personality issue, and then there's a whole other critique which really has to do with the whole issue of human rights. And I mean, the Republicans have really focused on criticizing her sort of handling of a lot of big national security issues like Iran, Israel, North Korea, saying they haven't been tough enough. And I think that those are areas where she has a pretty good case to make, that they have that she's got a good story to tell on that. She's also gotten a lot of hits from, groups like Human Rights Watch for being too For being, you know, not sort of fundamentally principled about human rights, and this is also a criticism that sort of plays out through American foreign policy, but that, you know, when it comes to our friends, whether it's Israel or whether it's countries like Rwanda or Ethiopia, that we soft pedal on issues of human rights and that we haven't been sufficiently tough. And there's a good case if you're interested, but the, you know, there was a mutiny underway in eastern Congo, and this group is alleged to be backed by the Rwandan government, which is a close ally of the United States, and they have been engaged in an extremely brutal military operation, including the seizure of Goma, the capital in eastern Congo, in the Kivus. And the U.S. has played the role of, in a sense, as kind of Rwanda's protector in the Security Council. Mm-hmm. The French have been pushing for, you know, language, pushing for sanctions against Rwanda to pressure them to stop the military operations of this mutiny, of the mutineers. And the U.S. has sort of behind the scenes tried to ensure that Rwanda is not named, is not signaled out, is singled out, is not sanctioned. And so, you know, that's a whole different issue in terms how you're playing it. And to me, it seems more of a legitimate critique and something that, you know, I think is kind of more interesting in examining her role than some of the stuff in Benghazi.
Well, and clearly, if she is President Obama's pick for Secretary of State, it seems to me that is all grist for discussion. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Norma from Bluebell joining us on Radio Times. And Norma, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks.
There.
First, I'd just like to say I am just so saddened by the deaths in Benghazi of our American people. And I am really saddened that this whole thing has overshadowed their deaths, their careers, and who they were. This woman has not even been nominated yet, which is kind of interesting to me. I'm wondering if your guest has any sort of opinion on the idea that the Republicans are trying to discredit Ms. Rice in an effort for her not to be nominated, and perhaps, as we all know, Senator Kerry's name has been floated as a possible Secretary of State, and this would be a backdoor way of them attempting to gain Senator Kerry's Massachusetts seat in the House.
In the Senate.
Thank you.
No, you're welcome, Norma. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And
you bet.
Colm, I've heard that theory before.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting theory. I don't know that. It's a bit of a conspiracy theory. It's not a crazy conspiracy theory. It's certainly something that I'm sure that, you know, Republicans and Democrats think about, you know, how all the chess pieces fit into place. And clearly, you know, his future in Massachusetts has been played into, I'm sure is playing into the discussions in the White House about what role he should or shouldn't get. But, I don't necessarily see McCain as someone as, you know, I mean, he's kind of independent-minded. I don't know that he would be the one sort of organizing a kind of broader sort of Republican strategy aimed at doing this. It might be the case, but, I mean, I'm just guessing. So I really have no idea.
Norman, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And, again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. But even going back to what either did or didn't happen in Benghazi and what she has said about Benghazi, does that raise questions for you about her fitness if she were to be the Secretary of State?
I'm sorry, her performance in Benghazi?
Her performance, and by that I mean her not in Benghazi, obviously, because she really had nothing to do with that, but how she talked about that and what she said on those talk shows and how she has handled herself since then. Do you think that raises questions about her fitness to be Secretary of State?
I think, you know, if you can establish, and I don't think it has been established, that she had really very, very good reason to question the briefings that she was presented with, then I think that would give you an indication that this is someone who places a higher kind of priority on, you know, on signaling the right political message than on, you know, just presenting the facts as they kind of honestly know them. So I don't know how that's going to play out. I mean, I'm always, you know, a little bit attuned to the idea that, you know, that particularly in the United States, where we have a lot of our top diplomats are not career foreign service, but are political people, that they do this, that there often is politics, you know, sort of interjected into their kind of, you know, into their public pronouncements and statements on foreign policy issues. And so, you know, this would signal that this is someone who is, you know, who is very political. And so that would probably have an impact on, for good or ill, on the way that they conducted themselves in those positions. So in the sense that, you know, are you more aligned with the president? Are you, you know, closer to the president? Are you, you know, and does that sort of create a kind of more powerful bond that mm-hmm. makes her a more influential and powerful Secretary of State? Well, then that might be something that's good. It's, being a political appointee is not inherently bad. It tends to indicate that you have a closer relationship with the top person. So, you know, that could be the case, but also, you know, it makes you, you know, it raises questions about the integrity of the briefing. So I don't, you know, I haven't reached a judgment on it. I also, you know, I'm very interested in what Pickering is able to establish in terms of his own investigation and in terms of, you know, precisely, you know, what kind of briefing she got before, you know, those Sunday talk show performances that she put on. So so I you know, for me, I don't know that I would you know that I would go one way or another whether she's fit or not fit to do it. I think it's worth looking at, but I just think there are other parts of her career and of her work that I think will give you a better idea of how good she is at carrying out policy and sort of pursuing American interests.
Well, since you have covered the UN and we're talking about either wrongful or misinformation, I'm thinking also of Colin Powell when he went to the UN, you know, holding up those little vials, talking about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which turned out to be, unbeknownst to him, apparently based on intelligence, turned out to be false. Does this, you think, rise to that level?
You know, that was a presentation that was provided that was leading the United States into war. It was the most serious thing that a government does, and I don't think you can put it on the same plane as the presentation on Benghazi. I don't, it's nowhere, you know, it's not in the same orbit.
Let me get to, looks like Chris from Ambler to join our conversation. And Chris, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, Terry. I'd like
to ask you. It's Marty, but that's
guest,
okay. Go ahead.
His opinion is, why aren't the two Republican senators not the issue here? They're being allowed to get away with the charade by posturing that the American public was lied to, when lying to the American public is standard operating procedure when it comes to protecting sensitive intelligence information. And both senators know this. So when terrorists want to deceive us, and sometimes the tactic is to pretend that you've been deceived. So they're playing a game of payback as well as angling for Senator Kerry. So no focus has been on them for their dishonesty and misrepresentation.
Well, Chris, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. A column you cover the UN, but I'd be curious about your thoughts.
Well, I don't cover that side, but I mean, you know, my colleague Glenn Kessler, you know, sort of has played up the, you know, he's made, who wrote a biography of Condoleezza Rice, and he has, in his, you know, column, the fact checker column, where he gives out Pinocchios for people who lie or bend the truth. He's sort of made an issue out of what he sees as McCain's lack of consistency and double standards on this issue. So I think it's not that it's not covered. You know, maybe the sort of the focus on Susan Rice and her performance has kind of become more of the central part of the narrative, but it is. I don't think it's been ignored. The whole question of you know, the comparison between, as you mentioned, and you know, in your earlier question, comparing this to the Bush administration's presentation on WMD in Iraq.
Let me quote your colleague, Glenn Kessler, looking at that article. He writes, but in 2005, McCain and Graham fiercely defended Condoleezza Rice from Democratic attacks of lying, arguing that she had been misled by intelligence. Quote, I can only conclude we're doing this for no other reason than because of lingering bitterness at the outcome of the elections, McCain complained when Condi Rice's nomination came to a vote. So it sounds like if you're paying attention, those words could come back to haunt him. Or have come back to haunt him. One thing you say about the current Susan Rice, the UN ambassador, is that she likes to travel. And we know from Hillary Clinton, I'm not sure how many miles she has logged as Secretary of State, but Susan Rice is an enthusiastic traveler.
Yeah, there are two elements to that story. One is that she likes to take a lot of side trips and she likes to drag the security the members to these on these visits to, you know, like clinics and stuff like that. Or sometimes they're, you know, facilities, U.S. facilities that she wants to visit, and they're not always so keen on doing it. But also there's another issue about Rice, and that is that, you know, while, you know, I mentioned that she's quite agreeable and charming and down to earth, she also kind of keeps reporters at quite a distance, and she's also very secretive and discreet and tries to keep us kind of at arm's length. And so, you know, it kind of sort of reflected a bit of that. One is that, you know, she takes people on these meetings, and if she's running the visit, which she was, you know, she does when she's in places like Sudan or Liberia, you know, a lot of the other ambassadors are kind of, you know, sort of grumble about being dragged on, you know, Susan Rice's, what they see as Susan Rice's personal tour. And so there's a hilarious quote from the French ambassador once complaining, you know, that the other 14 members of the Security Council were not the 14 dwarfs following you all around. And
well,
also,
Colin, I'm sorry to do this. They're okay. Playing my song. We have to end our discussion. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You too. And that's Colin Lynch from the Washington Post. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up next, it's Here and Now.